With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight back. It's time for the publisher fight back.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram power.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to episode 5 of the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm editor-in-chief of Video Ad News, which will soon be rebranding. We've got a new name. We'll be rebranding to Video Week. This week's guest is Belinda J. Smith, who is Global Diversity Ambassador for the WFA, which, as you might know, stands for the World Federation of Advertisers. Belinda is also a diversity activist and has had a glittering career in marketing, and her last role was as Global Head of Marketing Intelligence for EA, the gaming giant, which also has one of the most highly rated in-house teams in the entire industry. Being the week that it is, our conversation centres mostly on what's happening in the US with the Black Lives Matter movement. I think it's fair to say that our industry is playing an exceptionally important role, whether it's through social platforms and their relationship with President Trump, the countless attacks that we've seen on journalists, and in terms of how brands have been lending their support. Needless to say, we also discussed the issue of racial equality or racial inequality within our industry. Now, there are a few relatively minor audio issues in the first few minutes. Under normal circumstances, sometimes we'd have considered editing them out, but on this occasion, we chose to leave them in. Partly because we think Belinda is a particularly engaging speaker, and yeah, we felt the content was too good to cut. For me, this has been one of the most interesting conversations we've had in the podcast so far, but I also think it's probably one of the most important, and I'm particularly grateful to Belinda, who was able to make it at such short notice and with almost no preparation. So now I'll cross over to our chat, and yeah, I hope you thoroughly enjoy it. So, firstly, Belinda, how are you feeling right now?
I don't know why it's my immediate defense to laugh at that question, but I've done a lot of laughing at that question this week. I've been trying since last year, when people ask me that, to answer in a really truthful way, and over the past few weeks, I think it's just gotten so much more ridiculous. Today, chief emotion is just tired. I haven't slept much this week. I've been trying to really produce as much content as I can about what's going on in the world. And I'm very thankful that I don't have an employer right now, but that also means I don't have a PR team. So I've been doing a lot of outreach to people I new in previous roles, and really just trying to get some momentum going. I think throughout the past 6 or 7 days, I've felt really, I've kind of felt like the world has given me a hug, and I felt really loved and supported, just seeing so many people in the streets around the world. And for it to not be a one-day thing. And I think sometimes when I see smaller actions like this, you watch what's going on and you kind of hold your breath and say, you know, I hope the people on the news say the right thing, or I hope people continue to care about this tomorrow, or whatever it is. And I think that this moment has felt different because for whatever reason, everybody just seems to finally get it. And it's really comforting. And I think it's also really emotional for me because I'm Black. So I've lived this way my whole entire life. And since birth, I've never had one thought that the world was equal or that it was fair. As a child, you know, everyone says this and it's true. Everyone in America says this and it's true. As a child, my parents, you know, let me know who I could ask for help if something ever went wrong. But the rule in our house was that you never call the police ever. I've been afraid of the police my whole life. Yeah. So for me, this isn't something that happened last week. This has just been my normal reality. And it's felt really beautiful, to have people recognize that this isn't something that happened last week and that this is every day. And for me personally, that's a huge turning point in the conversation. Anytime that I talk about diversity or that we as an industry talk about having better creative or whatever it is, it feels so trendy. And this moment does not feel trendy. And that makes me so proud.
Yeah, it's great to hear. I think this, it's a lot of people marching. I think we've been marching in London, Paris, Dublin, Amsterdam, Berlin, and you know, hugely well attended. You know, I think, like, you know, often crowds that you wouldn't see for domestic issues in those countries. So I think like there has been a very kind of moving solidarity movement. I think that seems to be kicking off around the world. I think you're right. I think people are recognizing that this isn't just about that horrific 9-minute video where, you know, the murder of George Floyd. I think it's a recognition that, you know, enough is enough, and the Black Lives Matter movement that has been going on for the last few years now that has quite clearly fallen on deaf ears, and I think there is a feeling of drawing a line in the sand. Amidst all the scenes we're seeing of, you know, of anger and despair that we've seen, one of the recurring themes or the words, the language that's used, and you know, it's everyone from some leading politicians and activists right through to people who are just being interviewed on the street. People are saying how tired they are and how exhausted they are. Firstly, I mean, I think you've already said that, you know, it is something you can relate to. But can you explain about that feeling of exhaustion? You know, that you know, this is just, it's just going on and on and on. And in some senses, it seems to be getting worse at times than better.
Than better. it's really interesting to have these discussions because everyone's different. And I always have to start these discussions with acknowledging that I am but one person having my own unique experience. And what I say is 100% unique to me. And I not only respect, but expect and acknowledge that it's different for everyone. I mean, all the conversations I've had in my family in the past week have been really entertaining. No one's on the same page. But I think there are a couple of things that I can point to. One is a lot of Black people in America who have the access and ability to get their voices heard, whether that's in the press or on TV or self-publishing or whatever it is, a lot of those people, their entire adult lived experience, if not their childhood, is that of trying to assimilate to white America. And the cultures are incredibly different on many, many, many levels. And one element of I'm just so tired is having to actively censor yourself every moment of every day to make sure that you're keeping yourself safe and healthy and that you're able to provide for your family. So, you know, it would be like if you worked somewhere where you didn't speak the language and all you had to go off of were body language and people pointing to you. That's really mentally taxing to every single day show up and try to do a good job and try to do a better job than your peers and to know that you're not in a situation that was set up for you to win. It's really tiring. Mm-hmm. I think it's for a number of us that have been community organizers for a very long time and trying to you know, reach out and help our neighbors and educate people, that's lifetime work. And it's usually not rewarding. You have a good conversation one day and that has to be victory. And then you go home and read something and you feel like, what was it all for? So it's this Sisyphean task of trying to make change as one person, and it can feel really isolating and really tiring. And I think there's also this second wave of people who honestly want to help, and they have to turn to minorities to tell them how to help. And that's really tiring to have to hold yourself up and care for yourself. And then to have someone say, hey, you know, we want to release a statement as a company. Can you look over this and tell us how to make it better? I mean, it's mind blowing. And there's just so much there. But I think from my experience, those are the things that just make you feel weary.
I think there is. I think there's a, I think sometimes that thing of people asking for help and advice, I think that the media, and I think as, you know, an owner of a small media publication, I can understand this, where we, you know, the press can be quite scathing about people who, in quotes, get it wrong. And it's quite, there's an awkwardness around it. There's an embarrassment. And
I think there's two things. One is there's this really wonderful tweet floating around, and I'm gonna get it wrong, but it's to the extent of, you know, hey, for those of you calling to check in on your Black friends, I have an awkward message to deliver. Some of you don't have Black friends. The Black people you're calling to check in on are just people who have silently put up with your shit for a really long time and they don't want to hear from you. So I think that's part of it. Is it's generally, I don't think there's anything wrong with reaching out to a friend and asking for advice. But what this moment I think is showing a lot of people is the insufficientness or the fragility or the disingenuousness of the non-white relationships they do have, or the complete lack of those relationships. There are so many people who don't have anyone to call to say, what's your reaction to this? Is this okay? And that's a huge issue to me, that not only is this, you know, a diversity workplace thing or a racial justice or an equal rights thing, but there's still many adults today who don't have friends outside of their own belief constituency, outside of their own ethnic circle, outside of their own racial circle. So that has been something that's been really stark. And the other half of that is something that I talk about a lot, and I really hope that we are able to change over time, is we're not going to get anywhere without forgiveness. And the mob culture, the cancel culture, the, oh, sure, you're supporting me today, but 10 years ago, I was in your store and I felt, you know, racially profiled, so you don't have a right to speak on this discussion or this platform. That's not going to get us anywhere, because everybody has a shitty record. Nobody is perfect. Nobody has done this exactly the right way. So we can't exclude people from the conversation because their past actions weren't great. I want everybody who has a really shit record to come to the fore and to make a commitment. And we can say, and to say, you know what? We might not have a leg to stand on right now. We're coming from a poor place, but we seek to get better, and here's how we're going to do that. I would much rather you make a commitment that we can hold you accountable to than for you to say, oh, we don't really have a good record, so we're not going to say anything. I think that's something that we really need to change from a reporting standpoint, from a media standpoint, from a social media standpoint. Jumping down people's throats for not being perfect doesn't get us anywhere.
I'm inclined to agree. I think Dave Chappelle, I remember, he was actually speaking in the context of the Me Too movement, and he was saying that you need to have a mindset like, you know, like what Mandela did in South Africa of we're all going to change together and everyone needs to be on board, especially the people who don't, you know, interact with people outside of their own race. They're the very people that you want to feel like that they can be part of this too, and that it's not some sort of adversarial, race war, some people, particularly on the more extreme right wing side, are trying to position this as a race war, and that it's adversarial and not, and that inclusion doesn't, inclusion actually applies to everyone being included, not just minorities. It's about everyone feeling part of the same society.
And I think that happens on both sides, on the right and on the left. It's also, it's a fine line because I think people have deep experience with inclusion being weaponized. So all lives matter being a big discussion that we're having now. Sure, all lives matter. Of course they do. But yours isn't in jeopardy. So can you give me a moment to speak about mine? It's hard to balance.
Exactly. I mean, when they're saying, white lives matter, I mean, it just sounds ridiculous. Whereas Black Lives Matter, it's ridiculous that we have to even utter those words and that's something that has to be said. Yeah. And I think the fact that it does have to be said and that everyone instantly knows exactly what you're talking about. I think the name of the movement is ingenious. Before we started, we were saying about, how it feels like almost a trivial week to be talking about media and advertising. And yet at the same time, our industry is deeply enmeshed and entwined in this on various different levels. I think probably the one of the more prominent ones is the way the approach is taken by the social platforms. We've seen Twitter put warning over Donald Trump's tweets for incitement to violence, for saying, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Whilst we've also seen over Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg has been making the case for publishing Trump's message as on what he sees as freedom of speech, and which has led to sort of a lot of outcry by a lot of Facebook employees. We've even seen some sort of resignations and those resignations being very public and shared in social media. What, in your opinion, is the best approach for social platforms to take at a time like this?
Who knows? I have no idea. I mean, it's really difficult. Part of this is a lot of times I think we're asking the wrong question. A lot of times we try to figure out how we can deal with the symptom, that something is horribly wrong, as opposed to address further upstream that something is horribly wrong. I think about this a lot when I was still running media at EA with YouTube and brand safety. And it's just like, you're never going to be able to police everyone. You're never going to be able to get all the disgusting shit off the internet. You're never going to be able to protect children from seeing awful things. So what's the root cause of that? We almost have to address what systems are in place that incentivize this type of behavior. And in the light of the conversation that you and I are having right now, I think there's a really important and deep question, which is, what is it that's going on in the world that, makes it so easy to cleave down the middle of any society? It's not just the U.S. What is going on? Like, where is divisiveness coming from? And I actually think that's rooted in economic change. But the other thing that you can think about from the view of a social platform is, what kind of behaviors are rewarded in the social sphere? How do you have power, access, and influence in the social sphere? And for a lot of platforms, it is, you know, a dumb equation of how many followers you have, how much quote unquote engagement you get, and how effective your content is at drawing other people to and keeping them on the platform. And when you build a system that's monetized only by its ability to trap someone endlessly in use of that system, I mean, what else did we expect to happen but there to just be a bunch of fucking sensationalist trash floating around that people either want to read or want to log on to post something, you know, to decry it. It's a wheel, and it's designed to be that way. So, I mean, moderate comments or not, you know, I think that we all have different perspectives on that. I remember after the shootings in New Zealand, there was a discussion in the industry about, you know, well, everyone shouldn't be able to go live on Facebook. And my response to that discussion was, well, would we have known that the cops murdered Philando Castile in front of his girlfriend and their daughter if everyone couldn't go live on Facebook? So I don't think there's a way to moderate that makes everyone happy. I don't think there's a way to moderate that everyone will agree is fair. But if we look at how's the platform monetized, how are you incentivizing users, how are you surfacing and promoting content, those are some bigger questions that may have a waterfall effect on the types of content that we start to see people really, really focus on producing.
There is, the openness, I mean, there was a New York Times article back in March this year saying how, the Russian intelligence services were planning on using social media to partly fund, you know, white supremacist groups and to represent themselves as both black activists encouraging violence or white supremacists. It seems far too open to abuse and to disinformation rather than honest conversations. And I don't know whether validated IDs are part of the solution, where you can go on and say what you like, but we know that you are, you know, Sarah Brown, who lives here, and that you're taking this view, it's hard to say what the solution is. I do sympathize with the social networks to a degree.
I totally do. It's a tough business, but I also think, like, one answer could be like, all right, Facebook's not free anymore, so everybody pay for it.
Yeah,
I think that would rapidly change everything overnight. You know, I'm not really interested in getting wrapped around the axle on, well, here's this little symptomatic thing that we're not super pleased with. How do we manipulate, you know, that externality that's being created out of the system? The system sucks. It's broken. Change it. You know, why does advertising have to fund free speech? Like, who decided that was a good model? There are just so many other ways to cut it. But I think, you know, the people who own those companies and whose net worth is built on the stock of those companies definitely don't have an interest in ripping them down now. But that would be my thought or my preference for sure.
Yeah. We've seen, you know, just another dimension of the sort of the media is embroiled in all of this is that we've seen frequent and what appear to be deliberate attacks on journalists reporting on the streets. Yeah. Some of whom will be colleagues of people listening to this. I think, you know, in the media trading and advertising bubble, we suppose forget that there are these vast, you know, swathes of other people who, you know, attacks on journalists are typically something we tend to see with not only dictatorships, but the very worst dictatorships. And mm-hmm. I think not to belittle like everything else that's going on around journalists. I'm not just looking at this through a journalistic tunnel vision, but it really feels that like American democracy is at a crossroads of some sort and could go down a very dangerous path. What's your feeling on that, you know, in terms of where the American democracy is at today? And is there a real risk that something far more sinister can happen?
I'm sorry to laugh. This is one of those moments where it becomes very clear to me that they're just two separate countries based on what you look like. I've never thought of America as being, you know, this wonderful democracy.
Yeah.
My family, my friends, my neighbors can barely fucking vote. And when we do vote, we then have to question if they got counted or thrown away, or if it was written in such a way to make you vote for the opposite thing. Like, I've living here, I've never felt, hey, I have ownership over this country and I can affect it and influence it and change it, and I can vote, and that voting will, you know, result in some outcome. I just haven't felt that way. So it's funny, because when Trump was first elected, I think we started to have these conversations about, you know, this guy has no political experience and he just bought the presidency, and what's happening to our country? And I think minorities and marginalized communities were like, well, yeah, that's how it's always worked. Like, why are you guys freaking out? What's different now? Because we've never had money or power or access, and we've always been pushed to the side and run over by people who do have those things. So it's been our lived experience that America has functioned this way from the beginning. I was speaking with someone even before, you know, the latest round of public and video viral murders happened, and they were complaining about China. And I said, well, can you tell me fundamentally how the US is so different? I think for some of us who have benefited from America, we have really clung to a romanticized version of what it is and how it works. And some of us have not had the luxury to do that. So I think everything that's happening is horrible, and I'm not surprised by any of it. And I also don't think it's the first or second or third time any of this has happened. I think we're getting better at capturing things on film, and I think we're getting better at holding the public's attention for more than the 24-hour news cycle. And that makes me really hopeful and really optimistic. So I do recognize and acknowledge and empathize that there are a bunch of people who think that things are crumbling before their eyes. For me, I feel so hopeful, because I think all of these things that have always existed are now finally getting some airtime. And the first step to doing anything is being able to talk about it.
Just in terms of what you're saying about people starting to sort of speak openly about it, within the industry, we've seen, you know, 200 leaders. I don't know if you saw that, was sort of a story came out in the last couple of hours from when we're recording this, but sort of committed, saying that they're finally committed to action and not just words. Sad to say that I've heard that before. But it does feel like we might be seeing something of a watershed moment and more meaningful change, and that you know, people might be starting to realize that just having another panel about it isn't just the sole answer. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the moves in the industry to, you know, take action on diversity within the industry? I mean, you've been quite, you know, involved in the conversation, and have the public announcements translated into, you know, private action, do you think?
I mean, it's, I think it's too soon to tell. Those announcements, the oldest one is probably 5 days old, and you know, I think it's too soon to tell. We have seen stories that seem pretty similar before, but they have not had the groundswell of support that we're seeing now. So I feel pretty, not only hopeful, but I feel pretty certain that this will be different. I think what will be interesting is there are two things that I've seen start to coalesce. One is we're giving money to people who are experts and who know how to deploy those resources far better than we do, whether that's legal funds, whether that's the NAACP, the ACLU, whatever that is. And I think that's great because, you know, a huge problem in inequality is that we don't have economic access. So I think that's important for everyone to do. I think, you know, Verizon and Bank of America are contributing amounts that say something at 10 million and 1 billion over the next 4 years. You know, I'm not quite sure how a company who employs more than 100 people donating $75,000 is sufficient, but that's for everybody to decide. That's fine. So one is giving of resources, which I'll take it all day long. We are severely under-resourced and we need it. Thank you. And the second thing is, here are the actions we'll take. And a lot of those, which I think is appropriate and fair in the first 72 plus hours of this, is here's how we are changing internally. And hopefully there are external things that flow from that. But I think we have to be understanding and give people time to understand what that might look like. For companies who are committing to internal action, what I can say there is I've been at more than one company that is, I'm using my air quotes now, incredibly committed to diverse communities and to internal action. And that's easily weaponized. There, that's easily shown as, wait a second, you know, you have come to HR with a complaint or bad experience, but that can't be true. Because look at all of these official corporate programs we have that show how fair and just we are. So I think it will be interesting to see how those internal programs play out over the long term. For example, if you have one Black person who is your head of diversity, who's in charge of all those programs, you're done, you're cooked, you've failed. If your program is to educate your entire workforce and you're going to do that by having, you know, some kind of formal training and then declare it done, you're cooked. You know, you might as well not start. What I would love to see actually is employers enabling their marginalized employees to have conversations like the one we're having right now. I would love for, I'm just making this up, but I would love for, you know, Bank of America or Verizon to say, these are the actions that we committed to. You know, we're going to invite you in to talk to some of our employees and have them report on how they think things have or have not changed. I think transparency is going to be the key to all of this, especially in advertising and media, where there is such a long heritage of just completely gaslighting people and pushing them out and paying them hush money. You know, I think transparency and letting your workforce speak openly with others about how it's going is going to be really key. And I'm looking forward to doing that work. I'm looking forward to following up with companies. I'm looking forward to connecting with people and getting an honest perspective on what's working and what's not. Because the other thing is that we don't know what the answer is. So hopefully we find some things that are good and we can spread them.
It is. I think within the industry for us as, you know, as event organizers, it's something that it's something that we take really, really seriously in terms of representation on stage. I mean, it's, you know, I think anyone who shares an office with us, they just know the amount of work that we put into it. And often what we find is that, you know, if we have a black speaker, we'll often have more than one black speaker on stage, but then they're literally the only people in the room. I don't know who they're supposed to be inspiring. And then everyone goes back feeling good. Oh, we've ticked the diversity box. Everyone feels good about themselves. Oh, wasn't it great? And, you know, and I just feel like there's been far too much cosmetic lip service, you know, being paid to these things, and rather than people actually taking full on action. And that's not to say that the diversity at events isn't important, or that people shouldn't be campaigning for that and holding people to account that they don't have diverse lineups. I'm a big believer in it, but it is really important that those speakers are inspiring other people who are actually employed in the industry and are in the room.
And I also, you know, as someone who's been on a lot of stages, it also can be a really scary position to be in, to be on stage, this isn't a bad thing, but let's face it, to know that you're on the stage so that the panel isn't all white guys, to be carrying that, to know that your employer is going to be scrutinizing what you say on that stage and you can't fuck it up and you can't be as real as you want to be. And to also know that if there are black people in the audience on the live stream, watching the recap, whatever it is, they're going to believe you. So you kind of are put in this impossible position of, I can only represent things as being good and positive. If that's not true, I am potentially misleading people who I feel it is my duty to look out for. But if I say anything contrary to that, it's potentially, you know, at the peril of my livelihood. It's a really difficult position, and it's not fair. and so that's what I mean when I say employers have to let their employees speak in a transparent manner. Like, you should expect your employees to do some shit talking on you. And then hopefully they say, you know, it's not perfect here and it kind of sucks and it feels lonely, but that's why my employer has me on stage today, so that we can change it and so that we can make it better. But the way things are right now, I mean, it makes me really sad. It's almost like asking the people who are being marginalized to get up there and say that they're not. It's a really tough position.
I think there is. Yeah, I think there needs to be more honesty generally. I mean, just in every possible sense, the best speakers are always the most human, the most authentic, the people who speak freely. I feel bad for, you know, the people from Google who are often sent out to events and they're completely gagged by PR. Yeah. And you know that offstage these people have loads of strong views, would love to speak openly, but they're often just completely gagged and restricted. And as a result, Google ends up coming away looking worse as a company than they probably should, you know. And I think that thing of just allowing everyone to be a little bit more open and honest and to admit that the world isn't the way it should be, it would make for better events, certainly.
Yeah.
So, we've seen various brands this week trying to express their support and solidarity. I think it's fair to say with varying degrees of success. Have you seen any companies that you feel are kind of getting it right? And, you know, are there any that sort of jumped out at you as you feel that maybe they're getting it wrong or being opportunistic without, you know, what's your feeling on the brand reaction we've seen so far?
Yeah, you're not going to like my answer. I think everybody's getting it right. I think if you're saying something, you're getting it right. And this goes back to my insistence that we stop crucifying people for a wrong move, because then they'll stop showing up to do the work. I'm really grateful for how big of a movement this is right now. And again, I hope it stays present and top of mind with everyone. While I think everyone's getting it right, I also think some people are further along in their journey than others, is fair to say. You know, there are a lot of, I think people are already making fun of this, right? Like, here's the statement, copy and paste your company name here and update your Twitter and voila, you're part of the movement. And I say, like, yes, please do that. Because when you do that, I'm going to come back to you and say, you made this public commitment. Thank you. What does it mean? What are you doing? What can I expect from you? What is changing? I had a laugh last night looking at Twitter. Ben and Jerry's posted a graphic that said we must dismantle, I think was the word they used. We must dismantle white supremacy. And then, you know, there were like, hey, is this a new flavor jokes underneath it? But, you know, there were people who really tried to come for Ben and Jerry's last night that were like, oh yeah, a fucking ice cream brand of two white guys who were billionaires, like, tell me again about white supremacy. And other people were saying, hey, Ben and Jerry's has had, you know, racial equity is something that's been important to them for years. They give time, they give money, they call it out in their annual report. Like, they're not new to this game. And to me, those are the conversations I want to have. I want everybody to make a statement, and then I want us to be able to discuss, hey, actually, this company is doing it right. Or, hey, you still have some work to do, and here's what we'd like to see from you. You know, beyond that, at this moment, I don't think there's anyone who's just blown my hair back about how thorough and put together they've been on the issue. And that's okay. You know, start today. Make today the first day of you being really thorough and really great and really put together on the issue, and I will be beyond happy about it.
Well, I actually really do like your answer. I thought that was great. I'm of a similar view. I think one of the things when I've been in, you know, been doing business trips to New York, one year I was there around the week of Pride, and you know, there's a similar thing where everyone gets quite critical of companies that, on the bandwagon, all the rest of it. But one of the things that does is that it moves the conversation from a fringe activist and, you know, being something that's only owned by an aggrieved minority group. Mm-hmm. And it pushes into something into the mainstream where people can finally feel far more comfortable. So maybe a macho homophobic man all of a sudden kind of realizes, oh, actually everybody's on board with this, and maybe I need to think a bit more, or, you know, maybe I'm looking a bit ridiculous because it seems like the whole of society is buying into this.
Yeah.
And
I'm still really pissed off about it, but too bad, because now I'm in the minority, so I just have to shut up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Either way, you know, I think, like, you know, winning hearts and minds is always the preferable. But David Guetta, the DJ, he got quite badly slated. I think he put in the I Have a Dream speech over some EDM tune. Oh. And I think, you know, he got really badly slated. It was sponsored by HP. He was on a skyscraper. It was sponsored content. You know, it was probably a series. But I think his heart was in the right place, even though it was clumsy. Maybe somebody should have said. But, you know, I think if you're filming on a rooftop in the US, and it would be wrong for him to not say, he didn't immediately start dancing along to electronic music afterwards. And the whole thing just felt a bit incongruous and a bit weird. But I do think, you know, like I said, yeah, you should probably be forgiving it and think, like, he was trying and did it in his own way. And, you know, yeah, it's awkward and a bit embarrassing.
Yeah. And it never feels good to anyone when you are gnashing your teeth over the purity of your existence and your emotions and your movement. It never feels good. But also, if we could take some time and space and think, are you happier that we're having a fight about, you know, if it should have been sponsored content or EDM or whatever, versus actually you're just suffering in silence and no one's talking about it and no one cares, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
I agree. So Could you tell us a bit more about what you're doing with the WFA? So for people who don't know, that's the World Federation of Advertisers, and they have a diversity and inclusion hub, which I believe you are heading it up.
Yeah, so I am just such a big fan of the WFA. I actually joined as a member while I was leading global media at my last job, EA. And it's just, it's a wonderful global advertiser industry body. My peers in that group are, again, the global heads of media for large brands. It could be CPG or FMCG, it could be auto, it could be travel, whatever. It's a really diverse set of global stakeholders. And one of the reasons I love the WFA is out of the trade organization landscape, I think they are very unique in getting shit done. My experience with trade organizations previous to WFA has been, you know, it's a fine dance. And I used to work at one, by the way. I used to work at the IAB. It's a delicate dance of keeping your members happy, keeping your board happy, promoting the right trends and causes, being in the right conversations and at the right dinner parties. It's tough work. I think the WFA is freed from some of that because they don't have one market they operate in. They operate in all markets, essentially, and all of the local associations are members of the WFA. And I think that gives them unique leeway to maybe move a little differently or a little quicker than other organizations. Anyway, so that context is important because when I was at EA, I sat on the WFA's executive committee, and they were doing a lot of things with UN Women, with the Unstereotype Alliance around, you know, what we vaguely call diversity. And as an executive committee, you know, we decided that we were going to go beyond just gender and be brave and have conversations about race and ethnicity and all of the other forms of diversity that we know people are experiencing, but for some reason we're, you know, not really having meaningful conversation about. And so last year, while I was a member of the WFA, I also moonlighted as their global diversity ambassador. And really, it was my personal mission and passion just to raise awareness and to have, you know, I'm a Black American. So to have Black people included in this conversation and not let people off the hook by just talking about white women. So we've evolved that this year. We have now our second global diversity ambassador, Jerry Dakin from GSK out of London. And the two of us are really thinking, how can we grow this? And, you know, Jerry's causes tend to be in the LGBTQ space. Mine tend to be in Black and brown spaces. And it's okay, how do we continue these movements and how do we move them forward? And what the first thing we said is we really need an army. We need some smart people who have done this globally because we're not interested in solving for one market. We need people who have resources to offer us that we can pull from. We need people that we can learn from. We need people who can be our mouthpiece. We need people, you know, we just need an army. And so we have just kind of created our diversity and inclusion task force. And that task force is actually responsible for running the diversity and inclusion hub. So, COVID has really blown up our plans of what was supposed to kick off in Singapore in April. We are actually having our first task force meeting in the coming week or two. So, you know, we're not well underway with the task force yet, but our stated claims are that we are going to agitate. We're going to push into uncomfortable spaces and topics around diversity, and we're not going to shy away from conversations that seem touchy. And we are going to measure. Again, I love seeing all of these people post in solidarity because I will follow up with all of them. And we're going to measure What are the commitments? What's working? What's not? What are best practices? And it's not for us to beat our chest and be our own new initiative, but it's really to bring together, here are things that are happening in different places in the world. Let's corral them and put a global bow on it and offer those resources not only to our members, but really to the world. And let's accelerate and advance progress and change by, you know, not only corralling resources, but creating them. So that's kind of what all of that is about. And it's just been so surreal trying to get that off the ground in the current state of the world.
Tell me about it. You're speaking to an events organizer. Speaking of which, we should, we'll happily sort of lend our platform and events to you guys in terms of pushing it forward. So, yeah, the door is open. So looking to the future, I mean, you sort of touched on, you know, that maybe you're feeling, you know, quite positive in some ways about the future of diversity within the industry. Do you feel a sense of hope that that this is going to be a time of meaningful change, and that, well, it could be a watershed moment?
I don't know. I think it's hard to say. What I'll say to contextualize my feelings right now are that I've lived my entire life in fear that this moment is going to pass and it's just a fad. I grew up in the Midwest in mostly white suburban neighborhoods. And, you know, there were blips, like where people really liked Michael Jackson or Mariah Carey or Michael Jordan. And you thought, oh, maybe people, you know, will change. Maybe people will be more inclusive. Maybe they will be less racist and prejudiced. And, you know, things kind of always equalize and go back to normal. So I would say I have a lifetime's practice of being hopeful and fearful at the same time, and ultimately disappointed. And maybe it's that cycle that's prepared me for this moment. And the way I'm thinking about it now is, I don't fucking care if nobody cares tomorrow, because I will still be here tomorrow, and I will still care tomorrow. And I still have a voice. And I also think, you know, you're speaking to me in between jobs, and it's wonderful to not have to have an employer to answer to, and to be a free agent of my own time, and to work on things that only feel really nourishing to me. And I just feel like a lot of that fear that I've felt my whole life has really dissipated. I am not dependent on other people to validate that my pain is still trending on Twitter for me to know that it's important. And I think that feels really incredible. So I don't know if it'll be a watershed moment. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But, you know, in the cheesiest way, it's definitely felt like a personal watershed moment. And I feel a really weird amount of just peace about the whole thing. Yeah.
I think we touched on the protests earlier on. And I think, you know, the protests in the US as well, I think, you know, if the riots after, you know, Rodney King, or the protests that happened, you know, back in the early 90s, I think it was a predominantly black crowd. Whereas I think now, you know, Ice-T was saying that, you know, there was a bunch of raised fists, and he was saying, if you look at the spectrum of color in that crowd, and it does feel like there's more solidarity in sort of bringing about change than we've seen in the past. And personally, I'm more hopeful than I would have been before, that we could be seeing something something really is changing this time. You know, I'm still hopeful. So you know, you said earlier that people, you know, will reach out, and that people will awkwardly often not have a black friend and be like, yeah, what can I do to help, you know? But I think, you know, there are people who maybe, you know, aren't on the ground or are in Europe and, you know, will be going out to protests and everything else. But I mean, is there anything that it might not be immediately obvious to somebody who is sort of new to this conversation, or is just, you know, sort of maybe feels a bit awkward about how they approach it. But would you have any advice for them on what they can do? I know that's a big, broad question.
My personal opinion is really in the long term, the only way that this changes is active listening. And I think one thing that makes me sometimes not feel good when people reach out and say that they want to help is having experiences that show me that sometimes people reach out because they feel bad or guilty and they want to take an action to relieve that feeling of guilt from themselves so that they can move on with their life.
Yeah.
When you have an experience like that, I think it's incredibly hurtful and really belittling. And it may, you know, once bitten, twice shy, it makes you say, please don't reach out to me. No, I can't tell you what to do. But what I would say is, like, in this wonderful year of 2020, you know, Google is there for you. If you want to know some things that you can do, I'm sure you can type into a search engine and find no shortage of articles and opinions and resources and tips and tricks and hacks. I think that, you know, really getting clear with yourself on how you can create space for others to be heard is kind of the work right now. And maybe that means consuming a bunch of, you know, books or articles or podcasts that you didn't know existed before. But now after your Google search, you're aware of them and you're just going to really dedicate time to going in deep and trying to get closer to lived experiences of marginalized communities. I don't know. I think that will be different for everyone. But I think what I'd like to emphasize is there is no one action that you can take that is going to change my life. There is no one action that you can take that is going to absolve you of this conversation. There is no one action you can take that is going to make you okay on the racism issue. It's work and it's lifetime work and we all have to do it. And, you know, I don't know what that is for everyone, but I really encourage everyone to be super curious about figuring out for themselves what feels right and what doesn't. And I don't mean to be snarky when I say that you can use Google, but just honestly, the world is so big and there is so much in it and there are so many perspectives. You could, I think, very easily in a few clicks create a really robust learning agenda for yourself while you're locked down at home.
I think that's fantastic advice. I think so much of the root cause of this is a lack of empathy and ignorance. And I think, like, once you overcome that, you know, often I think it's just a question of people getting out there and just having proper conversations with people different to themselves, and you soon realize, oh, that person's just a perfectly normal human being. And, you know,
yeah.
And that applies to all types. You know, it could be a conservative American, or it could be anyone. You know, we all have to look out of our comfort zones a little bit and maybe have awkward conversations. And ultimately, I think most of us we realize our sort of common humanity once conversations happen. That's typically what will happen. Thanks so much for taking the time, Belinda. I'm at a loss for words, but I hope that next time we speak, it'll be under better circumstances and that we'll have seen some sort of meaningful progress on everything that's been happening this week.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for giving me some time as well. And this has been really good. And it's the start of something good. And I feel, you know, pretty certain that things will be in a more positive light the next time we sync up.
Great. Well, that's a lovely positive note to finish. So yeah, take care.
You as well.